evolution, redesigning the human race, and posing entirely new ethical questions. Space travel beyond our solar system will probably require either genetically engineered humans or unmanned computer-controlled probes. So even if life develops in other stellar systems, the chances of catching it at a recognizably human stage are very small. Any alien life we encounter will likely be either much more primitive or much more advanced. If it is more advanced, why hasn't it spread through the galaxy and visited Earth? If aliens had come here, it should have been more obvious, more like the film Independence Day than E.T. So how does one account for our lack of extraterrestrial visitors? It could be that there is an advanced race out there which is aware of our existence, but is leaving us to stew in our own primitive juices. However, it is doubtful it would be so considerate to a lower life form. Do most of us worry about how many insects and earthworms we squash underfoot? A more reasonable explanation is that there is a very low probability either of life developing on other planets or of that life developing intelligence. Because we claim to be intelligent, though perhaps without much ground, we tend to see intelligence as an inevitable consequence of evolution. However, one can question that. It's not clear that intelligence has much survival value. Bacteria do very well without intelligence and will survive us if our so-called intelligence causes us to wipe ourselves out in a nuclear war. So, as we explore the galaxy, we may find primitive life, but we're not likely to find beings like us. The future of science won't be like the comforting picture painted in Star Trek, a universe populated by many humanoid races with an advanced but essentially static science and technology. Instead, I think we'll be on our own, but rapidly developing in biological and electronic complexity. Not much of this will happen in the next 100 years, which is all we can reliably predict. But by the end of the next millennium, if we get there, the difference from Star Trek will be fundamental. Chapter 7. Brain New World. Do we live on a brain, or are we just holograms? How will our journey of discovery proceed in the future? Will we succeed in our quest for a complete unified theory that will govern the universe and everything that it contains? In fact, as described in Chapter 2, we may have already identified the theory of everything, TOE, as M-theory. This theory doesn't have a single formulation, at least as far as we know. Instead, we've discovered a network of apparently different theories which all seem to be approximations to the same underlying fundamental theory in different limits, just as Newton's theory of gravity is an approximation to Einstein's general theory of relativity in the limit that the gravitational field is weak. M-theory is like a jigsaw. It's easiest to identify and fit together the pieces round the edges of the jigsaw, the limits of M-theory where some quantity or other is small. We now have a fairly good idea of these edges, but there is still a gaping hole at the center of the M-theory jigsaw, where we don't know what's going on. We can't really claim to have found the theory of everything until we have filled that hole. What is in the center of M-theory? Will we discover dragons or something equally strange, like on old maps of unexplored lands? Our experience in the past suggests we're likely to find unexpected new phenomena whenever we extend the range of our observations to smaller scales. At the beginning of the 20th century, we understood the workings of nature on the scales of classical physics, which is good from interstellar distances down to about 1/100 of a millimeter. Classical physics assumes that matter is a continuous medium with properties like elasticity and viscosity. But evidence began to emerge that matter is not smooth, but grainy. It's made of tiny building blocks called atoms. The word atom comes from Greek and means indivisible, but it was soon found that atoms consisted of electrons orbiting a nucleus made up of protons and neutrons. The work on atomic physics in the first 30 years of the 20th century took our understanding down to lengths of 1/1000000 of a millimeter. Then we discovered that protons and neutrons are made of even smaller particles called quarks. Our recent research on nuclear and high-energy physics has taken us to length scales that are smaller by a further factor of a billion. It might seem that we could go on forever discovering structures on smaller and smaller length scales. However, there is a limit to this series, as there is to the series of Russian dolls within Russian dolls. Eventually, one gets down to a smallest doll, which can't be taken apart anymore. In physics, the smallest doll is called the Planck length. To probe to shorter distances would require particles of such high energy that they were inside black holes. We don't know exactly what the fundamental Planck length is in M-theory, but it might be as small as a millimeter divided by 100,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, galaxies that small. They would have to be larger than the solar system, and they're not likely to be approved in the present financial climate. However, there has been an exciting new development that means we might discover at least some of the dragons of M-theory more easily and cheaply. As explained in chapters 2 and 3, in the M-theory network of mathematical models, space-time has 10 or 11 dimensions. Up to recently, it was thought that the 6 or 7 extra dimensions would all be curled up very small. It would be like a human hair. If you look at a hair under a magnifying glass, you can see it has thickness. But to the naked eye, it just appears like a line with length, but no other dimension. Space-time may be similar. On human, atomic, or even nuclear physics length scales, it may appear four-dimensional and nearly flat. On the other hand, if we probe to very short distances using extremely high-energy particles, we should see that space-time was 10 or 11 dimensional. Brain worlds. If all the additional dimensions were very small, it would be very difficult to observe them. However, there has recently been the suggestion that one or more of the extra dimensions might be comparatively large or even infinite. This idea has the great advantage, at least to a positivist like me, that it may be testable by the next generation of particle accelerators or by sensitive short-range measurements of the gravitational force. Such observations could either falsify the theory or experimentally confirm the presence of other dimensions. Large extra dimensions are an exciting new development in our search for the ultimate model or theory. They would imply that we lived in a brain world, a four-dimensional surface or brain in a higher-dimensional space-time. Matter and non-gravitational forces, like the electric force, would be confined to the brain. Thus, everything not involving gravity would behave as it would in four dimensions. In particular, the electric force between the nucleus of an atom and the electrons orbiting around it would fall off with distance at the right rate for atoms to be stable against the electrons falling into the nucleus. This would be in accordance with the anthropic principle that the universe must be suitable for intelligent life. If atoms weren't stable, we wouldn't be here to observe the universe and ask why it appears four-dimensional. On the other hand, gravity in the form of curved space would permeate the whole bulk of the higher dimensional space-time. This would mean that gravity would behave differently from other forces we experience. Because gravity would spread out in the extra dimensions, it would fall off more rapidly with distance than one would expect. If this more rapid fall-off of the gravitational force extended to astronomical distances, we would have noticed its effect on the orbits of the planets. In fact, they would be unstable, as was remarked in Chapter 3. The planets would either fall into the Sun or escape to the dark and cold of interstellar space. However, this would not happen if the extra dimensions ended on another brain not that far away from the brain on which we live. Then, for distances greater than the separation of the brains, gravity would not be able to spread out freely, but would effectively be confined to the brain, like the electric forces, and fall off at the right rate for planetary orbits. On the other hand, for distances less than the separation of the brains, gravity would vary more rapidly. The very small gravitational field between heavy objects has been measured accurately in the lab, but the experiments so far would not have detected the effects of brains separated by less than a few inches. New measurements are now being made at shorter distances. In this brain world, we would live on one brain, but there would be another shadow brain nearby. Because light would be confined to the brains and would not propagate through the space between, We couldn't see the shadow world, but we would feel the gravitational influence of matter on the shadow brain. In our brain, such gravitational forces would appear to be produced by sources that were truly dark, in that the only way we could detect them is through their gravity. In fact, in order to explain the rate at which stars orbit the center of our galaxy, it seems there must be more mass than is accounted for by the matter we observe. Evidence for dark matter. Various cosmological observations strongly suggest that there should be much more matter in our galaxy and other galaxies than we see. The most convincing of these observations is that stars on the outskirts of spiral galaxies, like our own Milky Way, orbit far too fast to be held in their orbits only by the gravitational attraction of all the stars we observe. We've known, since the 1970s, that there is a discrepancy between the observed rotational velocities of stars in the outer regions of spiral galaxies and the orbit velocities that one would expect, according to Newton's laws, from the distribution of the visible stars in the galaxy. This indicates that there should be much more matter in the outer parts of the spiral galaxies. The nature of dark matter. Cosmologists now believe that while the central parts of spiral galaxies consist largely of ordinary stars, their outskirts are dominated by dark matter that we can't see directly. One of the fundamental problems for cosmology today is to discover the dominant form of dark matter in the outer regions of galaxies. Before the 1980s, it was usually assumed that this dark matter was ordinary matter comprised of protons, neutrons, and electrons in some not readily detectable form, perhaps gas clouds or MACHOs, massive compact halo objects like white dwarfs or neutron stars or even black holes. However, recent study of the formation of galaxies has led cosmologists to believe that a significant fraction of the dark matter must be in a different form from ordinary matter. Perhaps it arises from the masses of very light elementary particles such as axions and neutrinos. It may even consist of more exotic species of particles such as WIMPs that are predicted by modern theories of elementary particles but have not yet been detected experimentally. This missing mass might arise from some exotic species of particle in our world, such as WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, or axions, very light elementary particles. But missing mass could also be evidence of the existence of a shadow world with matter in it. Maybe it contains shallow human beings, wondering about the mass that seems to be missing from their world to account for the orbits of shadow stars around the center of the shadow galaxy. Instead of the extra dimension ending on a second brain, another possibility is that they are infinite but highly curved, like a saddle. Lisa Randall and Raman Sundram showed that this kind of curvature would act like a second brain. The gravitational influence of an object on the brain would be confined to a small neighborhood of the brain and not spread out to infinity in the extra dimensions. Like in the shadow brain model, the gravitational field would have the right long-distance fall-off to explain planetary orbits and lab measurements of the gravitational force, but gravity would vary more rapidly at short distances. There is, however, an important difference between this Randall syndrome model and the shadow brain model. Bodies that move under the influence of gravity will produce gravitational waves, ripples of curvature that travel through space-time at the speed of light. Like the electromagnetic waves of light, gravitational waves should carry energy, a prediction that has been confirmed by observations of the binary pulsar PSR. Binary pulsars. General relativity predicts that heavy bodies moving under the influence of gravity emit gravitational waves. Like light waves, gravitational waves carry energy away from the objects that emit them. However, the rate of energy loss is usually extremely low, hence very difficult to observe. For instance, the emission of gravitational waves is causing the Earth to slowly spiral in toward the Sun, but it will take another 10 to the 27th power years for them to collide. But in 1975, Russell Hulse and Joseph Taylor discovered the binary pulsar PSR 1913 plus 16, a system consisting of two compact neutron stars orbiting each other with a maximum separation of only one solar radius. According to general relativity, the rapid motion means that the orbital period of this system should decrease on a much shorter timescale because of the emission of a strong gravitational wave signal. The change predicted by general relativity is in excellent agreement with careful observations by Hulse and Taylor of the orbital parameters, which indicate that since 1975, the period has shortened by more than 10 seconds. In 1993, they were awarded the Nobel Prize for this confirmation of general relativity. If we indeed live on a brain in a space-time with extra dimensions, gravitational waves generated by the motion of bodies on the brain would travel off into the other dimensions. They would be reflected back if there were a second shadow brain and trapped between the two brains. On the other hand, if there was only a single brain and the extra dimensions went on forever, like in the Randall syndrome model, gravitational waves could escape altogether and carry away energy from our brain world. This would seem to breach one of the fundamental principles of physics, the law of conservation of energy. The total amount of energy remains the same. However, it appears to be a violation only because our view of what is happening is restricted to the brain. An angel, who could see the extra dimensions, would know that the energy was the same, just more spread out. The gravitational waves produced by two stars orbiting each other would have a wavelength which would be much longer than the radius of the saddle-shaped curvature in the extra dimensions. This would mean they would tend to be confined to a small neighborhood of the brain, like gravitational force, and wouldn't spread out much into the extra dimensions or carry away much energy from the brain. On the other hand, gravitational waves that were shorter than the scale on which the extra dimensions are curved would escape easily from the vicinity of the brain. The only sources of significant amounts of short gravitational waves are likely to be black holes. A black hole on the brain will extend to a black hole in the extra dimensions. If the black hole is small, it will be almost round. That is, it will reach about as far into the extra dimensions as its size on the brain. On the other hand, a large black hole on the brain will extend to a black pancake, which is confined to a vicinity of the brain and which is much less thick in the extra dimensions than it is wide on the brain. As explained in Chapter 4, quantum theory means that black holes won't be completely black. They'll emit particles and radiation of all kinds, like hot bodies. The particles and radiation like light would be emitted along the brain because matter and non-gravitational forces like electricity would be confined to the brain. However, black holes also emit gravitational waves. These would not be confined to the brain, but would travel in the extra dimension as well. If the black hole was large and pancake-like, the gravitational waves would stay near the brain. This would mean that the black hole would lose energy, and therefore mass, by E equals mc squared, at the rate one would expect for a black hole in four-dimensional space-time. The black hole would therefore slowly evaporate and shrink in size until it became smaller than the radius of curvature of the saddle-like extra dimensions. At this point, the gravitational waves emitted by the black hole would begin to escape freely into the extra dimensions. To someone on the brain, the black hole, or dark star as Mitchell called it, would appear to be emitting dark radiation. Radiation that can't be observed directly on the brain, but whose existence could be inferred from the fact that the black hole was losing mass. It would mean that the final burst of radiation from an evaporating black hole would appear less powerful than it actually was. This could be why we've not observed bursts of gamma rays that can be ascribed to dying black holes, though the other, more prosaic explanation would be that there aren't many black holes with mass low enough to evaporate at the age of the universe so far. The radiation from brain-world black holes arises from quantum fluctuations of particles on and off a brain, but brains, like everything else in the universe, will be subject to quantum fluctuations themselves. These can cause brains to appear and disappear spontaneously. The quantum creation of a brain would be a bit like the formation of bubbles of steam in boiling water. Liquid water consists of billions and billions of H2O molecules packed together with couplings between nearest neighbors. As the water is heated up, the molecules move faster and bounce off each other. Occasionally, these collisions will give molecules such high velocities that a group of them will break free of their bonds and form a little bubble of steam surrounded by water. The bubble will then grow or shrink in a random manner, with more molecules from the liquid joining the steam or vice versa. Most small bubbles of steam will collapse to liquid again, but a few will grow to a certain critical size, beyond which the bubbles are almost certain to continue to grow. It is these large expanding bubbles that one observes when water boils. The behavior of brain worlds would be similar. The uncertainty principle would allow brain worlds to appear from nothing as bubbles, with the brain forming the surface of the bubble, and the interior being the higher dimensional space. Very small bubbles would tend to collapse again to nothing, but a bubble that grew by quantum fluctuations beyond a certain critical size would be likely to keep on growing. People, such as us, living on the brain, the surface of the bubble, would think the universe was expanding. It would be like painting galaxies on the surface of a balloon and blowing it up. The galaxies would move apart, but no galaxy would be picked out as the center of expansion. Let's hope there's no one with a cosmic pin to deflate the bubble. According to the no-boundary proposal described in Chapter 3, the spontaneous creation of a brain world would have a history in imaginary time, which was like a nutshell. That is, it would be a four-dimensional sphere like the surface of the Earth, but with two more dimensions. The important difference is that the nutshell described in Chapter 3 was essentially hollow. The four-dimensional sphere wouldn't have been the boundary of anything, and the other six or seven dimensions of space-time that M-theory predicts would all be curled up even smaller than the nutshell. On the new brain world picture, however, the nutshell would be filled. The history, in imaginary time, of the brain on which we live would be a four-dimensional sphere which would be the boundary of a five-dimensional bubble, with the remaining five or six dimensions curled up very small. This history of the brain in imaginary time would determine its history in real time. In real time, the brain would expand in an accelerated inflationary manner like that described in Chapter 3. A perfectly smooth and round nutshell would be the most probable history of the bubble in imaginary time. However, it would correspond to a brain that expanded forever in an inflationary way in real time. Galaxies wouldn't form on such a brain, and so intelligent life would not have developed. On the other hand, imaginary time histories that are not perfectly smooth and round would have somewhat lower probabilities, but could correspond to real-time behavior in which the brain had a phase of accelerating inflationary expansion at first, but then began to slow down. During this decelerating expansion, galaxies could have formed and intelligent life might have developed. Thus, according to the anthropic principle described in Chapter 3, it is only the slightly hairy nutshells which will be observed by intelligent beings asking why the origin of the universe wasn't perfectly smooth. As the brain expanded, the volume of the higher dimensional space inside would increase. Eventually, there would be an enormous bubble surrounded by the brain on which we live. But do we really live on the brain? According to the idea of holography described in Chapter 2, information about what happens in a region of space-time can be encoded on its boundary. So maybe we think we live in a four-dimensional world because we are shadows cast on the brain by what is happening in the interior of the bubble. However, from a positivist viewpoint, one can't ask which is reality, brain or bubble. They are both mathematical models that describe the observations. One is free to use whichever model is most convenient. What is outside the brain? There are several possibilities. One, there may be nothing outside. Although a bubble of steam has water outside it, this is just an analogy to help us visualize the origin of the universe. One could imagine a mathematical model that was just a brain with a higher dimensional space inside, but absolutely nothing outside, not even empty space. One can calculate what the mathematical model predicts without reference to what is outside. Two, one could have a mathematical model in which the outside of a bubble was glued to the outside of a similar bubble. This model is actually mathematically equivalent to the possibility discussed above, that there is nothing outside the bubble. But the difference is psychological. People feel happier being placed in the center of space-time rather than on its edge. But for a positivist, possibilities one and two are the same. Three, the bubble might expand into a space that was not a mirror image of what was inside the bubble. This possibility is different to the two discussed above and is more like the case of boiling water. Other bubbles could form and expand. If they collided and merged with the bubble in which we lived, the results could be catastrophic. It has even been suggested that the Big Bang itself may have been produced by a collision between brains. Brain world models like this are a hot topic of research. They are highly speculative, but they offer new kinds of behavior which can be tested by observation. They could explain why gravity seems to be so weak. Gravity might be quite strong in the fundamental theory, but the spreading of the gravitational force in the extra dimensions would mean it would be weak at large distances on the brain on which we live. A consequence of this would be that the Planck length, the smallest distance to which we can probe without creating a black hole, would be quite a lot larger than it would appear from the weakness of gravity on our four-dimensional brain. The smallest Russian doll wouldn't be so tiny after all, and might be within the reach of particle accelerators of the future. In fact, we might already have discovered the smallest doll, the fundamental Planck length, if the US hadn't gone through a fit of feeling poor in 1994 and cancelled the SSC, the superconducting supercollider, even though it was half-built. Other particle accelerators, such as the LHC, Large Hadron Collider at Geneva, are now being built. With them and other observations, such as the cosmic microwave background radiation, we may be able to determine whether or not we live on a brain. If we do, it will presumably be because the anthropic principle picks out brain models from the vast zoo of universes allowed by M-theory. We could well paraphrase Miranda in Shakespeare's The Tempest. O brain, new world, that has such creatures in it. That is the universe in a nutshell. This is Simon Preble. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Universe in a Nutshell by Stephen Hawking. This program was produced and directed by Paul Rubin. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2001 by Stephen Hawking. Production copyright 2001, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.